Welcome, dearly beloved, to LNL on RN Summer. Later, some fascinating Japanese poetry with Roger Pulvers. But I want to revisit a controversial subject that we've discussed quite a few times, the NDE, yes, the near-death experience. My guest, Dr. Sam Parnia, believes that these experiences are now reported so routinely, few people who've studied in the field can doubt it's a real phenomenon that warrants further study. But he has a problem with the term near-death experience, preferring to call it an actual death experience because he doesn't think it entirely and accurately reflects the science of what's now being studied. Sam has written one of the first medicine-based studies ever conducted of what happens to the mind and psyche after the heart has stopped. He's currently conducting the world's largest ever study of mind and brain during cardiac arrest, the so-called AWARE study, an initial 3 to 5 year long investigation of patients who claimed to have been aware of being resuscitated. The good Dr. Parnia is a critical care doctor, director of resuscitation research at the Stony Brook University School of Medicine in New York, and he's also the founder and director of the Human Consciousness Project at the University of Southampton. Sam's the author of The Lazarus Effect, the science that's raising the boundaries between life and death. And I welcomed him to our New York studio.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be on.
In parenthesis, I'm just curious as to your own religious inclinations before we plough on.
Well, I don't have any religious inclination. And it's important to understand that I come, and people like myself, come from this from the perspective of intensive care medicine. Our goal as intensive care physicians is to ensure that patients who are critically ill do not die and that we can save them. However, whether we like it or not, unfortunately, a proportion of our patients do die and they go beyond the threshold of death. And what's important to understand is that through the advances in resuscitation, particularly in the last 10 years, we are now able to reverse death after it has occurred for a period of not just a couple of minutes, but tens of minutes, if not hours of time, after a person has literally turned into a corpse.
That's the thing that I find so extraordinary, that the time scale has been so extended so quickly.
Absolutely. This is what is fascinating, and this is why I think it's important for people to understand. And part of the reason I wrote the book is to really bring everyone up to the 21st century, rather than the 20th century with respect to the subject of resuscitation science, but also what implications it has for our understanding of what happens when we die. And that's essentially what I do.
We'll get onto that a little later, but as you point out, traditionally what doctors have been doing since the 60s, 70s is essentially, or are essentially, chest compressions and providing breath to a person, CPR. But now there are other technologies available, which include, of course, automated CPR machines that deliver both breaths and chest compressions.
That's right. It's important to explain, if I may, just take two steps back to explain to the audience what we're really talking about. Most people who are listening, if not everyone, has a perception of what is death. And the perception that we have, by and large, is that there is a moment that you reach, and when you reach that point, you cannot come back, and that is what we consider death. Now, medically, the way that death has been defined and continues to be, you know, if someone gives a time of death in hospitals, it's when the heart stops beating. And as soon as the heart stops beating, for whatever illness that may have caused that, whether it's a gunshot wound or a meningitis or a heart attack or whatever it may be, eventually the heart stops beating, and as a consequence, people stop breathing, and then the brain shuts down, and that's why people develop fixed and dilated pupils of the eyes. In other words, they lose their brain reflexes, and that person becomes lifeless, and this occurs within moments. And we define that as death, and that's always been the definition of death. Now, what we've come to understand is that obviously, up till about 1960, that was essentially that point, and that's why we have this perception that there is a moment, there is a point. Now, at 1960, by chance, a number of physicians in the United States discovered what we now call CPR, which is that essentially, after a person has just died, if you do chest compressions, you can artificially create a circulation again, and if you give them breaths, then you can sort of sustain them. And that led gradually to this understanding that we can actually go beyond the threshold of death for a short period of time, say 10 minutes or 20 minutes maximum, and then bring people back sometimes. And so the way that we use to bring someone back to life after they've died is understanding what those processes are that occur after death, manipulating those processes, and ensuring we can restart the heart and bring back a whole person without brain damage. And that is the sort of art and science of resuscitation science in the last 10 years.
Without brain damage?
The key thing is that there have been a number of very important discoveries in the last 10 years that, if put together and implemented, will ensure that we can prevent brain damage, or at least minimize it significantly, in people that we can bring back. And this is one of the key discoveries from the medical side of what we do.
Tell the listener the extraordinary story of Joe Tirolosi, the New York taxi driver.
Well, if you look in the medical literature now, there are many people who have been brought back to life after prolonged periods that we thought was impossible. Joe Tirolosi is a patient that I personally took care of when I was at Cornell Medical Center in New York, at least for part of his stay. And he was somebody who was brought into the hospital and had resuscitation, in other words, CPR, for almost 50 minutes. Now, the key thing is that not only did he have this very prolonged CPR and resuscitation phase, but actually he came back without significant brain damage, even though this was quite prolonged. And the key thing that really helped him was that at that time, there had been a New York-wide process of implementation of cooling people who had just died. And it's important to understand that cooling is very important because when a person has no blood flow to the brain, the brain cells will start to die. But if you can cool them down, and I'm not talking about freezing, but just chilling them, so from 37 degrees to 32 degrees, you can slow down the rate by which the cells are undergoing death and therefore keep them in this sort of hibernation phase. And so he received that as well as a number of other important therapies. But having said that, as incredible as it was, and he, you know, was all over the newspapers, if you look in the medical literature, there are more profound cases, more incredible stories. And the longest case of a person who I've seen being published in the medical literature, which was in 2011 in the journal Resuscitation, was a case of a young Japanese woman who actually died in a forest, was not found for at least, it sounds like, 4 to 10 hours possibly, but was eventually found by a passerby, literally without any CPR. Now I'm talking about nothing. Received CPR once an ambulance arrived all those hours later, and was taken to a hospital. Now in Japan, they use a particular system, which is almost standard of care in their emergency rooms, where they have a machine called ECMO. It stands for extracorporeal membrane oxygenation. It literally is a device that takes blood out of a person's body, provides oxygen to it on a membrane on the outside, and then pumps it around the body. And so they kept her on this machine for up to 6 hours, and then eventually her heart started. And within 3 weeks, she left the hospital walking out. And I understand from her physicians that she had a baby in the last year. So this is really what we're talking about, which is absolutely completely profound.
I'm just, the silence is because it's quite mind-boggling. Still on the notion of the cooling process as a means to slow down cell damage and deterioration, tell us about a third case, that of Aaron Basson.
Well, this was an interesting case because, as you pointed out at the beginning of our conversation, I've been actively involved in resuscitation research for a number of years, and I work with hospitals across the UK where we study not only the brain in order to make sure we can bring people back safely, but also their consciousness and what happens to a person after they've gone beyond the threshold of death as part of the AWARE study. And one of our collaborating hospitals in London contacted me to say that they had this remarkable case of a patient that they had brought back to life. And he was in his 50s, had gone to, you know, have a drink. It was sort of in December, and didn't feel well, eventually made his way to the hospital, and then he died just as he arrived. Now, that particular hospital is incredible because they have kitted their emergency department with machines that can deliver chest compressions beyond what any human being can possibly do. So he arrives, they see that he died, they put him on the machine, and he had what we call technically an asystole, which basically means he was completely flatlined, which is generally thought to have almost no chance of survival. He was, however, put on this machine, and they continued CPR for 3.5 hours with the machine. And incredibly, they managed to get him back, which was completely astonishing, and it was all over the newspapers again. And he actually left the hospital a few days later, thanking everybody and walked out himself.
And once again, without significant brain damage.
Without significant brain damage, that's right. And that's remarkable because they had the machines, and also because it had been the winter, he himself had become relatively cold before his heart stopped. And therefore, the fact that his body was cool preserved his cells while he got excellent CPR and he came back.
Sam, I remember a very fine essay in New Yorker some years ago pointing out that there was no standardization at that time of anesthesia, of the machines that were used to deliver it, of the protocols, the knobs that turned left on one machine, turned right on another, and using the aviation industry as a symbol or as a metaphor. A couple of doctors worked very hard to achieve standardization, and once it was achieved, the mortality rate was vastly decreased. What is the dynamic at the moment? Because, of course, one of the problems in the area we're discussing is that not one medical area owns the idea.
You've raised a very important point, which is that, we have to go back a little bit in history. If you think about it, in the 1930s or 40s, medicine was not very advanced. And therefore, it was possible to ask a single doctor to be relatively knowledgeable about a fairly large area of work or body of work. But as medicines become super specialized, we find that it's impossible to ask any, and perhaps very good doctors, to be up to date with everything all the time. And cardiac arrest suffers from the fact that by virtue of being death, people can die under the care of any number of doctors under many different wards or areas of hospitals. And therefore, it's very difficult to ensure that all doctors with different areas of expertise, different strengths, different weaknesses, are fully up to date with all the advances that they need to know and to implement. And what you find is that most people, and this includes most physicians in all honesty's perception of cardiac arrest care, is literally still limited to what was the 1960s, i.e. just doing a series of chest compressions and providing a series of breaths and maybe giving some drugs and maybe giving the odd electrical shock if warranted. And that, to me, and the way I try to explain it in the book, is that really this is the most basic form. But it really is the 20th century form of resuscitation, and there have been enormous advances in the 21st century which need to be implemented.
Very often it's wartime, it's the military that seem to have driven quite a lot of progress in medicine, trying to keep soldiers alive on the battlefield. Has the Pentagon got interested in your work?
Well, I'm not fully aware of everything the Pentagon does, but I do know that the defense in the United States are obviously very interested in finding ways of minimizing brain injury in people who have had either traumatic brain injury because of gunshot wounds or who are getting what we call anoxic brain injury, in other words, a lack of oxygen when the heart stops and a person's just gone through death. So, yes, I think there is interest in that. But I think the problem that we really have, as you pointed out earlier, is that we need, for example, in the United States, we need the federal government to come in and set up standards of care that hospitals need to abide by and that they are obliged to report their survival, their practices, whether they deliver good quality, even basic chest compressions, how they deliver their breaths, as well as the more sophisticated care such as cooling, which unfortunately is not mandated, and therefore you have individual doctors making their own individual decisions, and having many chefs is never a good thing when you're trying to cook.
The science of medical resuscitation is one thing, the ethics is another. At what point would you not attempt to resuscitate?
In my opinion, if you look at all the advances that have occurred, it's important for us to put together all of these links together in order to save people who have a chance of having a meaningful life when we bring them back. And it's important to appreciate that cardiac arrest, by definition, is the only medical condition that every single one of us will go through There's no doubt about it. I will have it, you will have it, and so will every single listener. And what we don't want is for our chance of coming back to be dependent on chance, or our ability to come back but have or not have brain damage be down to potluck, which is the way it is today. So in my opinion, if we put everything together, then the decision needs to be made before a person has died. In other words, if someone has a medical condition that cannot be cured and treated, let's say they have cancer that unfortunately has spread enormously, for which there is no treatment available today in 2013, then when their heart stops, we shouldn't even do the most basic forms of chest compressions at all. We should just stop because there's no hope. We could not eliminate the problem that caused them to die. However, there are many of us who will die of things that are reversible. Let's say someone who has an infection and it just takes them away before the antibiotics would work, or they have a car accident, or they have a heart attack, or conditions that are essentially treatable by medical science today. Well, if we then implement all these higher standards of care, we can ensure that we can bring them back. So it's almost like we have to decide to give the right patients everything. And those of us who unfortunately, you know, cannot be cured of our ailments or have reached an age where we feel that we should be allowed to go, then I think we should respect that dignity and stop.
Alan L. on RN Summer, and this is a chat with Dr. Sam Parnia about his book, The Lazarus Effect, and his extraordinary work on resuscitation. Now, let's go back to Joe Terolosi, because his case raised all the questions you'd been studying and was also the convergence of the two lines of investigation you're pursuing, resuscitation on the one hand and the fundamental mystery of human consciousness. Now, you interviewed Joe a few days after he awakened from the induced coma. What did he tell you?
Well, I actually found out about Joe Terolosi because the nurses who were taking care of him contacted me saying you must come and talk to him when he woke up in the coronary care unit when they took him out of his coma. Because they said he's had a profound experience and we don't feel equipped enough to talk to him about it. So when I spoke with him, it became very clear that he had indeed had a very profound experience. He described this enormous sense of relief, peace as he'd gone through his cardiac arrest, and that he'd met this being, a being of love that's full of compassion, that guided him through his experience. And this is not uncommon. A lot of people do describe a sensation of either seeing deceased relatives, almost who've come to welcome them, or seeing a being of light that guides them through. And sometimes they have an instantaneous panoramic review of their entire life. And what's fascinating is that many of them describe that they end up judging their own actions. So not only do they see what they do, but they actually feel what they did. So for instance, if someone had caused pain upon somebody else, even if it was by accident, it wasn't meant to be, they will still feel the discomfort that their actions had caused other people. So they themselves essentially judge. And then many of them, of course, go on to a place that they describe as being very beautiful, that they did not want to come back from. But for whatever reason and different reasons, they eventually come back.
Perhaps you weren't always doing them a favor with, with resuscitation. Okay, as I mentioned, I know three people who were dead for various lengths of time. None of them reported anything as amiable or pleasant as what you're describing, but I'm well aware that there are many, many hundreds of cases, and you've collected 500 yourself, of people who had what used to be called an NDE. You don't like the term. You think it's scientifically problematic.
If you look at the history of near-death experience, it's very interesting. You know, as I mentioned, we discovered the system of CPR in 1960, and the first book that was published on near-death experiences came out in 1975. And it described, in essence, the experiences that people had had who'd been critically ill and who'd been brought back to life again, some of whom had had a cardiac arrest and actually gone beyond the threshold of death. However, the term near-death is very, very problematic because it's enormously vague. If you're studying something in science, you have to be precise. And in medicine, we have no term, we have no such term as near death. I mean, you either die or you don't die or you're critically ill. And the conditions that make you be critically ill, whether it be meningitis, a gunshot wound, road traffic accident, different types of infections, heart attacks, cancer, whatever you may think of, their underlying biology is enormously different. And to clump everything together is highly problematic. And I think to a large extent that is what has caused a lot of the controversy and the debate, because people have put together things that are very different under one umbrella, and then they fight and they debate about them. So it's important to appreciate that the people that we study are those who've gone objectively beyond the threshold of death. We understand the biology of death very precisely. We know that as soon as the heart stops, even when you do CPR, that there is no brain activity within 2 to 20 seconds. Everything goes completely flat. The brain flatlines, everything flatlines. We then also understand, you know, minute by minute, what happens to brain cells after a person has died, whether they receive CPR or whether they don't receive CPR. And so the biology becomes completely standardized. And that's why for those people who've gone beyond the threshold of death, I like to call their experiences an actual death experience.
Okay.
Because scientifically, we can now study them. We can compare them. We have no more fog. We have no more gray zone. So that's really that point. And if I may, I just want to address what you brought up earlier, right at the beginning of the conversation as well, about the people that you know who've had no experiences. Classically, we know that 10 to 20% of people who go beyond the threshold of death will come back with these incredible experiences, which are universal, have been described from all over the world, and they've been described in millions of people now. They're all over, from children less than 3 years old to any age that you can think of. The reason why the majority of people don't recall them is most likely because when a person's gone through death and we bring them back, the first thing that happens is their brain swells up enormously and it becomes enormously inflamed. And therefore, their memory circuits become completely wiped out. So it's a little bit like the fact that we all know, for instance, that we dream every night. But if you were to ask us, we don't remember the dreams. It doesn't mean we didn't have them. And so while, you know, the three people you mentioned said to you, oh, well, there was nothing there, no, there's no judgment, there's nothing, doesn't necessarily mean there was nothing. It's more likely that their memories were wiped out as a result of the effects after they came back.
I asked you at the outset about your religious views, but I accept the argument that we're describing or discussing something which seems to occur universally across cultures and religions. And I also read with interest that people generally describe the experience as being a transformative and positive one. Their lives are enhanced by the experience. As a result, they describe themselves as being more altruistic and less materialistic, less self-centered, less afraid of death. Okay. Talking about this decades ago, Susan Blackmore, whose work I'm sure you're familiar with, argued that what we might be dealing with is simply a process, effectively a mechanical shutdown, that these images, these sensations, might simply be the brain closing down.
Well, I think you've raised a number of very interesting issues there. First of all, I'm a big admirer of Susan Blackmore's work, we go back many years, actually. In order to really put this into perspective, it's important to realize, again, what Susan Blackmore was talking about was this vague entity of near death, where people could be at different levels of illness and different stages, which is not the same as people who've had a cardiac arrest and gone beyond the threshold of death. In essence, after near-death experiences were described, a number of people tried to fit it into a scientific model. So, for instance, Susan Blackmore suggested that this may be due to a lack of oxygen affecting the brain that may be causing an illusion, at least in terms of the tunnel effect and seeing the light. And others came through with other opinions. Most of us who are involved in the field today in the 21st century from different parts of the world agree that actually those explanations were appropriate at the time, but are not supported by the evidence that's come through over the last couple of decades. For instance, we know that there's no relationship between oxygen and having these experiences. People have them under different circumstances. And there have been, of course, thousands of studies of the effect of oxygen in people. As you pointed out, I'm a critical care doctor, and almost every night that I'm on call, I deal with many patients who have low oxygen levels. And we don't see them having anything that resembles a near-death experience. So I think the general consensus, at least with those who are actively involved in the field, not those who are looking out from the periphery, is that this is a universal experience that we cannot account for using models such as oxygen, carbon dioxide drugs, because there is no supporting evidence for them.
Might it perhaps, and I'm putting on a Richard Dawkins cap, might it perhaps be an evolutionary development to make death less terrifying?
If I may, I'm going to focus on the patients who I study, which are those who've gone beyond the threshold of death, to explain this. It's, as I pointed out earlier, when a person has died, the brain shuts down within moments. And that's simply logical because there's no blood getting into the brain. When you then do CPR, even if you do great quality CPR, you cannot get enough blood into the brain to reactivate the circuits and generate any electrical activity. And we know that in order for the brain to communicate, you have to have electrical activity and communication between different parts of the brain, which become completely flat during the time of what we call a cardiac arrest, even with CPR. So at that time, there is no time for people to have any kind of psychological reaction. It's not like you have time to imagine you're about to die. This happens in an absolute instant. Your heart suddenly stops and you're gone. So it's very hard to imagine that this is something that's sort of evolving gradually. If you were looking at people perhaps in a hospice who are slowly dying, you might be able to put forward those kind of arguments. But there's very little evidence to suggest that. What we do know is that it appears that after a person has died, at least in the first period of death, in other words, the first few hours, that entity that we call consciousness, the thing that makes us aware, thinking beings, does not become annihilated. It simply hibernates, and we as the outsiders cannot see it. So to us, the person looks like they're completely unconscious, but actually it does not become annihilated. And that's why we probably have reports of people who do claim to be able to see things, hear things, and accurately describe exactly what was happening in the rooms, conversations, clothing, etc.
This is the so-called out-of-the-body experience.
That's a term that's been used to describe this. Again, as far as I'm concerned, this is simply reports of awareness during resuscitation, which is what led to the AWARE study.
Well, in the time we've got left, can you talk to the AWARE study? AWARE is awareness during resuscitation.
You see, again, if we sort of take off, and this is one of the things I've tried to do in my work, is to demystify the concept of death and make it into a scientific entity and allow us to study it and understand it from that perspective. If you take away social perceptions and philosophical perceptions about death and just boil it down to science, when a person dies, as I said, brain activity ceases, but the cells inside the brain only start to undergo their own process of death at that time. Now, biologically speaking, there are parts of the brain that are involved with your conscious awareness, the fact that those of us who are talking or listening to the radio, we're fully awake and alert. That's because certain parts of in the middle of our brain have numerous chemicals that are at a particular balance that keeps us awake. For instance, if you take a strong antihistamine, especially the older generation, histamine itself is involved with putting you to sleep or keeping you awake, depending on the levels, as are various other chemicals. So when a person dies, and I'll just explain a bit more, if you have a general anesthetic, for instance, those chemicals work on those areas of the brain and they switch off your consciousness. If you get a severe illness like liver failure and you have chemicals building up in your system, those chemicals will affect those parts of your brain that keep you awake and alert, and they put you into a sleep, and if it's deeper, you go into a coma. So when a person dies, biologically speaking, all that's happened is you've stopped delivering oxygen to those parts of the brain that keep a person awake and alert, and as a consequence, they go into a deep coma, like would occur with any other condition. Now, obviously, as time progresses, those cells involved in the structure of the brain will eventually start to go through their own process of death and will eventually decay to a point where you cannot get the person back. But that's why I explained that at the beginning of death, the evidence is that consciousness is not annihilated. It's very similar to what happens when you're given a general anesthetic, when you appear to be completely unconscious or in a coma, but it hasn't disappeared into thin air. There's something still there, and I think that's why they can recall what's going on.
At the same time as looking at your book, I've been rereading Oliver Sacks' latest on hallucinations, and Oliver's an old friend of the program. And there are certain overlaps between what he's coming up with or what he's reporting on in terms of what might be called altered states of consciousness and your studies of the brain and consciousness. Have there been any results yet to the overarching aware study that you can reveal?
Well, I've had a lot of inquiries about the AWARE study through the years. It's a completely new study, new type of study, I should say, because we're trying to essentially study consciousness and awareness in people who should have no brain activity, which obviously makes it very difficult. And unfortunately, for various reasons that are out of my control, many of these patients are not brought back to life. And as I explained earlier, those who are brought back, the majority of them have their memories wiped out. So it's hard. So I've tried to summarize the results at least up till the end of 2012 in the book. And in essence, yes, we've had people who've had awareness, not as many as we had hoped because we've had fewer patients come back to life in order for us to interview them. And so the study, after 3 to 5 years of sort of going through a feasibility stage, we have taken on what we've learned and we're trying to adapt and change it and move on based upon the evidence that's been coming through.
Of course, Sigmund Freud had quite immense difficulties in trying to make sense out of dreams. It must be immensely difficult for you as a scientist to deal with ephemera like awareness experiences.
Well, consciousness itself is the biggest mystery probably in science. You know, what is it that makes us into who we are? Why am I a thinking, conscious being? Why do I seem to have the ability to make decisions for myself? And why do I have all types of emotions and rational thought and all the rest of it? Of course, this is not something that only we have been interested in. This goes back at least to the time of the great Greek philosophers, if not just before. And if you boil down, you know, in a very simplified way, the philosophical arguments that have now led on to science today, you find that there were two different sort of viewpoints. But in essence, what the Greeks referred to, and they called it the psyche, was what made a person who they were, their psychological functions, their morality, their ethics, their emotions, etc. And then the word psyche was later translated into the word soul into English. But at the time, the Greeks didn't necessarily believe that the psyche or the soul, or what we now call consciousness, was necessarily everlasting. Many of them, including Aristotle, believed that when you die, because the psyche, the soul, or consciousness is a product of bodily processes, when the body dies, that also dies. There were, however, others, such as Plato, who believed that actually psyche, soul, or consciousness is separate from the body and therefore continues to exist after we die.
Where do you stand on this, Sam?
I don't have any personal opinions because I've been thoroughly involved in this for so long. But what I can say is that for the first time, we are able to try to answer these questions through the objectivity of science. And if you look at the evidence that's coming through, it does suggest that we should at least consider the possibility that consciousness may continue when the brain does not function and the person's gone beyond the threshold of death, which, of course, if proven further, would support Plato's view rather than Aristotle's view.
Sam, thank you for this. Talking to Dr. Sam Panea, a critical care doctor and director of resuscitation research at the Stony Brook University School of Medicine in New York. Sam's book, The Lazarus Effect, The Science That Is Erasing the Boundaries Between Life and Death, and it's published here in Australia by Random House. Thanks, Sam.
Thank you very much.
Roger Pulvers is a Japan watcher, resident of that country for many years, as well as being a writer and professor emeritus at the Tokyo Institute of Technology. For over 40 years, Roger's been studying and translating the work of Japan's greatest modern poet and a children's story writer, Kenji Miyazawa. Kenji offers us a different side of Japan, including that pre-war militaristic Japan, and his messages of compassion and respecting nature seem highly relevant now. Roger joined me in the Sydney studio, and I asked him to read a particular poem of Kenji's, which he believes sums up just what he was on about. The poem is called Strong in the Rain.
Let me just say, first of all, this is his most famous poem, and this poem is, without a doubt, the most well-known Japanese poem of the modern era, which means of the last 160, 70 years. Particularly came to the fore after the Tohoku earthquake and tsunami of March 11th, 2011, because Kenji is from Tohoku. He's from Iwate Prefecture, which is the biggest prefecture in Japan, next to Hokkaido. And the coastline was destroyed. I've been up there quite a number of times in the last 2 years. It's been devastated. He was from an inland city, so his hometown of Hanamaki was all right. But this poem was taken up as a symbol of hope, that the one thing about Japan has been shaking, rattling, and rolling, and has been inundated for centuries. I mean, Kenji was born in 1896 and died in 1933. Now, a few months before he was born, Philip, there was the great Meiji Sandiku earthquake. Sandiku is that area of the coast that in Tohoku that was destroyed 2 years ago. Over 22,000 people died in that earthquake and tsunami. That's 2,000 or 3,000 more than died in the last one. The tsunami reached 38.2 meters. It reached 9 meters in Hawaii. Obviously, there's no nuclear reactor at the time. That's the year he was born. A couple of months before he died in September 1933, another earthquake hit the Sandiku area. Over 6,000 people died. Similar tsunami hitting the entire coastal region. And yet, the Tokyo Electric Power Company said, you know, this is unprecedented, and we're unpredictable, and so on. If you walk around that area, you see scores of monuments, stone monuments, about the size up to your waist, or sometimes a little higher. And it says, it's dated March 1896, and it says, the tsunami came up to here. Don't build below this point. You know, so this is the area he came from. And yet, the Japanese people have always come back from tragedy. I think the whole world admired their resilience, their fortitude, and their compassion, their selflessness. And this is what marks Miyazawa Kenji's work. And this poem is called Strong in the Rain. Strong in the rain, strong in the wind, strong against the summer heat and snow. He is healthy and robust, free from desire. He never loses his temper nor the quiet smile on his lips. He eats 4 go of unpolished rice, miso, and a few vegetables a day. He does not consider himself in whatever occurs. His understanding comes from observation and experience, and he never loses sight of things. He lives in a little thatched roof hut in a field in the shadows of a pine tree grove. If there is a sick child in the east, he goes there to nurse the child. If there's a tired mother in the west, he goes to her and carries her sheaves. If someone is near death in the south, he goes and says, "Don't be afraid." If there are strife and lawsuits in the north, he demands that the people put an end to their pettiness. He weeps at the time of drought. He plods about at a loss during the cold summer. Everyone calls him blockhead. No one sings his praises or takes him to heart. That is the kind of person I want to be.
A moment's silence while we let that sink in. Everyone calls him blockhead. That is the kind of person I want to be. So he would be horrified to listen to our program tonight and to hear that his country may once again be reliant on nuclear energy.
Yes, energy was a big theme with him, with Kenji, and the main point of all of Kenji's work, if you could put it into one or two sentences, it would be that you must not destroy nature in the production or the generation or the transmission of energy. And That's exactly what Japan is a very small country that has 10% of the world's active volcanoes. It is whether one might well be in favor of nuclear energy in some countries. I'm not, but I can understand that. But it is untenable in a country like Japan. And so Kenji says we must work with nature. If there's one, actually, Kenji has a wonderful short story called Indra's Net, and he takes that image from Buddhist philosophy.
I was going to say that the poem seems to be imbued with a Buddhist sense.
Oh, he was a devout Buddhist, but he was also a practicing scientist. He was an agronomist, an amateur geologist, an astronomer, and he was also a poet. I mean, he's the mixture of Walt Whitman and Lewis Carroll.
It's interesting, isn't it, that nature was literally his passion. And he indicated little interest in sex or intimate relations with humans.
Well, he believed very strongly in intimate relations with humans, but there's no romance and there's no sex in Kenji's works. He's the only modern Japanese writer that one can say that about. But that came from his belief in abstinence and his religious fervor. But what I was going to say a moment ago about Indra's net is that Kenji's metaphor for interpersonal relations is that we are all connected by the threads of a net, and not only human beings, but animals, and not only organic life, but inorganic life as well. He sees all creation as a matter, as being interconnected with the rocks, with the air, with the light.
Well, of course, that's a scientifically tenable argument, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, it is, but he does
but
it.
But he anticipated the holism.
Absolutely. Yeah, okay. So if one thread breaks, or if we cause one thread to break, then we lose that interconnectedness.
Given the simplicity and the purity of his life, it's surprising he didn't live longer.
Tuberculosis. I mean, he was actually he died of TB at age 37, and he lost his very beloved younger sister at age 24 from the same disease, despite the fact that he was very wealthy. The Miyazawa family was one of the wealthiest families in Iwate Prefecture, in this prefecture in northern Japan, and he was an avid musician and a composer. I mean, he did absolutely everything. He had the biggest record collection in northern Japan, and the president of Japan, of one of the Japanese record companies, wrote to his representative in Iwate Prefecture and said, "You've been doing a great job. You know, we're selling more records up there than we sell anywhere else in Japan." And that fellow wrote back and said, "Sorry, there's only one guy who's buying all the records." So he was very much involved in people. And his involvement was very much one-to-one. His most famous story is a short novel called Night on the Milky Way Train. It's a story of two boys to whom he gives Italian names, Giovanni and Campanella. And they are on a train. They find themselves on a train going through the stars. And they go from constellation to constellation. Actually, they end up by the Southern Cross. So they go from the Northern Hemisphere to the Southern Hemisphere. And Kenji never left Japan, so this was all a fantasy. And then at one point, towards the end of the novel, Campanella disappears, and Giovanni doesn't know where he went. And then Giovanni wakes up on top of a hill, realizes it was a dream, goes down to the town, down to the river, where he hears that a boy has drowned in the river. And this is a story about how one person envisions the death of someone who's very close to him. And Kenji's main message in that is, how do we overcome grief? How do we come to terms with the death of loved ones? How do we come to terms with the death of, with loss? And his answer is the same in every case. You overcome it because you're always thinking of other people, not of yourself. The other person's grief, a relative of that person, you take on that person's grief as your own. And this was the message that the people of Tohoku picked up.
I know you well enough to say something you will find incredibly embarrassing, and that is, in a way, you want to be him.
Do I? Well, I don't know. I certainly know that I discovered Kenji's work very early after I arrived in Japan in 1967. And I went up to Hanamaki and I met his brother, who was just about, he was younger than I am now, but and took a very, very deep interest in Kenji's work. And perhaps I wouldn't have become a writer myself if it hadn't been for him. But
well, I have to say, he'd be rather
proud. I can't be a saint like Miyazawa Kenji.
I've never accused you of that. Okay, back to Japan. To what extent is this extraordinary fellow celebrated there? Is he required reading for Japanese school students, for example?
Absolutely. He's in all the textbooks for this poem and a couple of the other short stories. But, you know, like anywhere else, when you study somebody in school, you don't take to him as readily as you do.
Well, often opposite is true, isn't it? But kids, Kenji, get a lifelong loathing of Shakespeare, for example.
Yeah, unfortunately. But Kenji was totally ignored and neglected in his lifetime. And then around in the 30s, some of his books started to come out. But it was only after the war that he began to be recognized as a major writer. And yet, he wasn't studied in foreign universities. He was sort of pigeonholed as a hick from, you know, a children's story writer or a fantasy writer, not someone to really be taken seriously as a representative of Japan until 1995, January, the great Hanshin earthquake in Kobe, where about 6,500 people died. And then in March 1995, the sarin nerve gas attacks on the Tokyo subway lines. And in 1991, the asset bubble had burst, and the Japanese people were saying to themselves, well, what's happened to us? We're falling apart at the seams. And that's when there occurred in Japan a very major Kenji Miyazawa boom. And people turned to him because he said, you can get through it if you don't think about yourself, if you sacrifice yourself for other people. And that message, of course, appeals to the Japanese people who have that strain in their national character.
Everyone calls him blockhead. No one sings his praises or takes him to heart. That is the kind of person I want to be. Your translation is incredibly accessible and colloquial. Is that the tone of voice in which he
writes?
Yes,
it is. Yes, it is.
So no one finds it difficult to
comprehend. No. He wrote this down, this poem down, Strong in the Rain, in his little black notebook when he was very ill about four years before he actually passed away. And he didn't really mean it as a poem to be published. He only published two books in his lifetime, and both were self-published, and both didn't sell at all. Now they're worth a fortune if you can find one of them. But it was only after the war that this was picked up as a kind of incantation, an ideal, because, you know, Kenji was always saying to himself, not what Westerners or religious people in the West ask themselves, that is, what am I doing here? Why was I born? You know, why? He's not concerned with that at all. He's asking himself another question. Why am I me? Why was I born as myself? And he answers it, and he never said this. I'm answering it for him because, you know, it's just, I've been studying it for so long. His answer is, I think, I'm not me, I'm you. Or I am not only me, I'm you too. Yeah. And it's not that the people of Tohoku who have suffered so much, and you go up there and say, oh, you people have suffered, I feel so sorry for you. What you're going through is terrible, and you cry with them. No, that's a very good thing to do. It's not empathy. He goes beyond empathy. In all of his works, he says, your grief is my grief. It's not something I identify with. It's not something I empathize with. It is my grief. And therefore, your happiness is my happiness. And one of his most famous lines is, until all people in the world are happy, there is no such thing as individual happiness.
You know, I'm fascinated by the clarity and the accessibility of the writing. I have a problem with much poetry in the Western tradition because you actually need the Enigma machine to begin to fathom out what the hell it means. And here's a guy, he just writes with this absolute translucent, even transcendent simplicity. And I take it the prose was like this.
The stories are so lyrical and so beautiful, and they're always written from the standpoint of the child or an animal, because he was a vegetarian from age 21. And to think, there are very, very few vegetarians in Japan now, let alone then. And he was a animal welfare is another theme in his works. And this, you know, we're talking in the 1920s. You know, which even now the Japanese are, you know, having a hard time coming to terms with, you know, animal welfare that as an issue. And the stories are, he is a writer who has totally retained the view of the child. Now, they say that about other writers in the West, like Lewis Carroll or Hans Christian Andersen, but it's really not the case. It's still, you know, they describe children very well and the world of children. But the business about romance and sex comes in here.
I think J.M. Barrie comes closer.
I see. Oh, yes, J.M. Barrie.
Because he was, in effect, a child. He never grew up.
Yeah. Well, Kenji did grow up and had very adult concerns about the state of the world. But his prose shines with the most beautiful usage of the Japanese language, which makes it very hard to translate because it's so unusual and lyrical and full of onomatopoeia and so on. Kenji gives light and hope to Japan, and I would hope to the world too. And I'm not saying this in a soppy sort of spiritual sense. In a real sense, this is a writer who should be read to tell us that it is worth to going on living and to dedicate ourselves to our children and to the future. And that is the future of Japan. I'm very optimistic about the future of Japan, actually.
The Admirable Roger Pulvers, Professor Emeritus at the Tokyo Institute of Technology, talking about the Japanese poet Kenji Miyazawa. On our next, another snippet from the LNL USB stick with that doyen of Australian theatre, Robin Nevin. Stick around now for the news on RN.